Welcome to School and Around, a podcast hosted by Branching Minds, featuring prominent leaders, subject matter experts, and thought innovators with their perspectives on the current challenges facing K-12 education. I am your host, Larissa Napolitan, a former teacher, instructional coach, and a member of the Branching Minds team, here to lead conversations and to shine a light on phenomenal educators and those that are on a mission to transform our schools and the lives of students. Maybe you've been listening for a while, or this is your first episode. If you like what you hear, would you do us a favor by rating and reviewing us on iTunes? This is a fantastic way to tell us you enjoy what we are creating. Also, if you want more MTSS resources, sign up for our weekly newsletter using the link in our show notes and check out our website for all the blogs and guides you would ever need about MTSS. I'm sure I'm not alone in having a lot of different emotions about school violence and school shootings. And so today we are actually going to dive into this topic in relation to MTSS. And it's all about integrating that behavioral threat assessment into your system of support. And so we're going to explore practical protocols and procedures that schools can adapt to proactively address potential threats while also providing meaningful support to students. And the key is a unified team-based approach that ensures communication and collaboration every step of the way. Joining us are two incredible experts in the field. First, we have Dr. Dewey Cornell, a forensic clinical psychologist renowned for his research on youth violence and school safety. He's a professor of education at the University of Virginia and the principal author of the Comprehensive School Threat Assessment Guidelines, widely implemented across U.S. and Canada. We're also thrilled to welcome Dr. Elena Zong, who is our MTSS practice lead at Branching Minds. She has an extensive experience leading multi-tiered systems of support at school, district, and state levels and brings a practical and grounded perspective to the discussion. Both Dr. Cornell and Dr. Zong blend their research-based insights with real-world strategies and offer an approach that is both actionable and effective. So we're going to start out by hearing from Dr. Cornell, who's going to break down what threat assessments are and how schools can implement them successfully. Then we're going to go into a discussion between Dr. Cornell and Elena about implementing threat assessment within your MTSS. So take it away, Dr. Cornell.
Now, threat assessment is kind of an unfamiliar term. It's not a traditional educational term. But in fact, it's actually something that we do quite a bit. When a student is angry or upset, every teacher, every principal, every school psychologist, everyone in the school who knows that student is going to be doing some kind of threat assessment. In fact, you might be doing a threat assessment of this girl right now. You're looking at her body language, her facial expression. And if she was your student, you would be thinking about, what do I know about her? What is she concerned about? What is she likely to say or do next? So in other words, you're doing a threat assessment, but what you're doing is subjective and intuitive, and you're probably doing it solo. And so the question is, when we do a threat assessment in our school, can we do a more systematic and objective process? And with the high stakes that we have in schools today, we want to be as objective and fair in our process and as accurate. But, you know, many schools that don't have a formal threat assessment process will rely on zero tolerance. That is, and they will automatically remove the student from school regardless of the seriousness or the context of the situation. They'll simply have a school removal policy, and maybe they'll say, well, come back when you've got a note from your doctor that says you're safe. And that's the kind of referral folks in the community really don't like to receive, because it's kind of an impossible task. So threat assessment is really focused on not removing the student from school, but trying to understand what is the threat, what is the nature of the risk, and what should we do about it? Because we know that removing a student from school doesn't actually increase safety. It may feel like an automatic thing to do, but really what we want to do is we want to supervise the student, we want to monitor them, teach them, support them, and try to resolve whatever underlying problem or conflict there might be. In fact, many schools are now doing threat assessments. At least this national survey of schools last year found that 85% of schools in the United States say they have a threat assessment team. Now, of course, there's lots of different ways to do a threat assessment. And so we're going to dig a little bit into what might be an appropriate and effective way to do a threat assessment. Now, threat assessments have really three phases. The first phase is identification. And by that, I mean that you need to have a school climate and environment where students and adults alike know that it's important to report threats of violence or concerning behavior that raises concern about potential violence. And at the second stage, we need to have a team, a multidisciplinary team, who will evaluate the report. All threats are not the same. The team needs to gather information and evaluate the seriousness of the threat. And then third, based on that evaluation, they will undertake appropriate interventions integrated with their multiple systems of support, multi-tiered systems of support, to address whatever underlying conflict or problem might be associated with the threat.
Wow, there's so much there that I had not considered. Now, I know that you just kind of went into the what, and maybe we have a general assumption as to the why behind threat assessments. Maybe you can share a little bit more about the particular support that you found for having a threat assessment.
We need it because we want to prevent violence. But let me emphasize, prevention means to keep something from happening. And very often in school security conferences and meetings, we focus a lot on reacting to an act of violence, responding to a crisis, rather than preventing the crisis from occurring. And so keep in mind that crisis response is not prevention, and threat assessment is not a crisis response. It's a preventive action. By way of analogy, you don't prevent forest fires by waiting until the trees are blazing, right? You want to take action a lot earlier than that. And in the case of schools, we're talking about conflicts and arguments and maybe bullying that's going on. We want to intervene early before they escalate to the point of a forest fire. And of course, school shootings are terribly traumatic. They may be statistically rare, but they have a huge impact. And they have convinced many policymakers and folks in the public that schools are not safe. And I want to push back a little bit on this idea. I want to acknowledge that we have a very serious problem with school shootings. And in 2024, we had 22 schools that had a shooting homicide. Certainly 22 is far more than we want, 22 too many. But what we also have to keep in mind is that we have 130,000 K-12 schools in the United States. And so statistically, 22 is a very tiny percentage. The average school statistically can expect a homicide every 5,900 years. About every 6,000 years, a school will have this happen. So from a practical perspective, the vast majority of schools will never have a homicide. And so that ought to be some reassurance that our schools are much safer than it seems or it feels. And in fact, the concern we have for violence is a legitimate concern. We have a high rate of gun violence in the United States, a high rate of homicides as a result. But most of those homicides are not occurring in schools. These are statistics from the FBI on homicides throughout the United States, so over a five-year period. So we've got pretty reliable trends here. And as you can see, the vast majority of homicides occur in people's homes. Domestic violence is a very serious problem. But we have homicides in the streets and parking lots and gas stations and outdoor places and restaurants, 1,400 homicides in restaurants. Restaurants have 10 times as many homicides as schools. Yet no one is talking about restaurant violence or, you know, putting metal detectors in restaurants. Nobody is saying we need to have armed guards at the door of restaurants, even though the risk of homicide is 10 times greater.
These statistics definitely paint a different picture than I maybe had assumed or understood. And I know that our fears for violence in schools is not unfounded, but can you share a little bit more about why having a threat assessment can prevent more violence?
School shootings are terribly traumatic, and they have convinced us that schools are less safe than they actually are. And so I want to focus on prevention rather than crisis response there. But what we're dealing with, though, are not just shootings, but threats of violence. And after every school shooting, we see a surge in threats. So within 3 weeks of the shooting at a Georgia high school last fall, there were more than 700 students around the country who were arrested, many more who were suspended or removed from school because of concern about threats. So while statistically schools will almost never have a student who's going to commit a homicide, every school is dealing with students who make threats. And so we've got to do an assessment. We have to understand what is going on with that young person and what should we do to help them. So we have a lot of students in our school who are going to say make a threatening statement or engage in some kind of threatening behavior. And most of the time, almost all of the time, it's not a serious threat. And so we've got to have threat assessment to deal with that. Now, these students who make threats that are not actually planning to carry them out, many of them are angry or upset. They may be frustrated. They may be wanting to fight someone. We have kids, particularly in our middle school grades, who get into fights with one another. We also have students who are making threats as a joke or a prank, or they're trying to seek attention because it certainly garners a lot of attention to post something on social media that is frightening. And we also have the problem of false reports of threats. So someone might make a report that, you know, Johnny is going to shoot up the school. And they think that's a funny thing to do, but it can cause a lot of concern in the school and get Johnny into trouble that he wasn't planning on. Well, let me just say that threat assessment is a process that has to avoid two kinds of errors. So there's only two mistakes you can make in threat assessment. And this is important: overreaction or underreaction. That is, when a threat is reported, we don't want to overreact. Here's this little boy who brought a little piece of plastic to school. It's part of an action figure. It's shaped like a gun. And under zero tolerance, he was expelled from school for 1 year as a gun violation. Well, of course, a threat assessment team would say, well, a piece of plastic is not the same as a gun. Let's look at what he was doing, why he did it, and let's have an appropriate response, which would be well short of removing him from school. On the other hand, the other kind of error that we're, of course, concerned about are underreaction. That is a serious threat, a youngster who brings a gun to school. And we've had cases where youngsters have brought a gun to school and the school did not respond. They underreacted and a shooting took place that could have been prevented. So we've got to avoid overreaction and underreaction. All right, that's why we need threat assessment.
Yeah, I can see that both would be pretty common, the over and under reactions. So can you go into a little bit more about how does the threat assessment actually work?
I'm going to give you an example of a threat assessment program that my colleagues and I developed at the University of Virginia. This is the Comprehensive School Threat Assessment Guidelines, or CSTAG. And this method, like other threat assessment methods, uses a multidisciplinary team to gather information to assess the threat. Our model in particular follows a decision tree to decide how serious the threat is, to take protective action if the threat is serious or substantive, but always to try to understand what problem or concern underlies the threat and what can we do to resolve that to help the student. And that's where it's very important to have our multi-tiered approach, to have an array of interventions and programs that we can apply as needed to the individual student. Now, threat assessment in some schools is done by a lone ranger. That is, the school psychologist is told to do a threat assessment, or the assistant principal has this as a other duties as assigned. And we don't want threat assessment to be a solo process. There are no lone rangers in threat assessment. We want a multidisciplinary team, preferably a team that's in the school, because most cases can be handled by school staff. We occasionally have more serious or complicated cases, and we could draw upon outside consultants, or we could bring in, we might have a district level team that or community level team as well. So there's some flexibility here. But primarily we have a team in the school that's going to handle most cases. And this team is going to have usually a school administrator, often the person in charge of disciplinary decisions. And then you want to draw upon your mental health staff. And I know schools differ a lot in who's involved in that, but we want mental health staff. We want a school resource officer, if you have one on the team, and other school staff as well. So threat assessment, we want to prevent violence. We want to help troubled students and avoid overreactions. Okay, so threat assessment, of course, is part of a comprehensive approach. It's not a standalone program. It should be integrated with your multi-tiered system of supports. We have a lot of forms available. Now, we don't fill out all these forms for every case because we do a triage process, but we have a process that is standardized and systematic, and you won't have to think of everything because we've arranged things to help and guide you through the process. We have a decision tree, a five-step decision tree that allows you to resolve simple cases quickly in just one or two steps, and more serious cases with the full five steps. So we start off by interviewing the student, asking some basic questions to understand what happened, what they said, what occurred. We gather information from multiple sources and see if we can then figure out how serious this case is. I'm going to give you some examples of that, but generally in a threat assessment, there are four possible classifications for. First of all, a report of a threat might turn out not to be a threat. Maybe it's a false rumor. It might not be a serious threat. It might be just rhetoric or anger or overstatement that's a transient threat. It might be a threat to fight someone. We have kids who want to get into fist fights or shoving matches, and that would be a serious substantive threat. And if the threat is more than that, if the threat involves threatening to shoot or stab or kill or severely injure someone, of course, and it's not just rhetoric, we think there's some serious intent, that's a very serious substantive threat. So those are the four types of threats that we want to look at. We've got four categories. We did a study of 3,400 schools in Florida who were using our model for 2 years. And during this time of period, 11% of the threats were not a threat, 71% were transient threats, so altogether over 80% were resolved. And in terms of serious substantive threats, about 10 to 15%, and about 5% of threats were very serious substantive threats. We found this the similar proportions. They vary a little bit from school to school, but we found similar proportions across several different studies in Virginia and elsewhere. Well, an evidence-based practice is one that has been tested with scientific studies and found to work. Don't take my word for it. Don't take someone else's word for it. We need to test programs, collect objective data, and show that that the program works. And in fact, that's what we've been doing. My team at the University of Virginia has been conducting research on the CSTAC model for 25 years. We've published in a lot of different journals across different fields in psychology and education and criminology. But what we found across studies is, first of all, that threat assessment is a safe process. We have resolved thousands of threats without violence. We've had some threats that were attempted, but we've had no shootings, no fatalities. 99% have had no serious injuries. About half of 1%, we had a kid who got into a fight, was seriously injured enough to go to the ER. We've also found that using threat assessment has led to less bullying and aggression in schools, and that students and teachers report a more positive school climate when they're using the threat assessment approach. In terms of the impact on individual students, the vast majority of the students who receive a threat assessment are assessed, found to need some kind of support services. Now, this might range from brief counseling or education to school discipline or to more extensive programs. It depends on the nature of the case. But most students do receive some type of support services. Most of them remain in their school. 90% remain in their school. Suspension rates in these schools actually go down because they're not relying on school exclusion. When we look at racial disparities, which is a big concern in American education, racial disparities are diminished or not present. In terms of law enforcement actions, they actually, very few students are arrested or subject to any kind of legal action. So that's in a nutshell what we have found in our research. But threat assessment is an approach that is designed to be safe, effective, fair, and equitable, and to basically divert students from school exclusion as an outcome to services and support as an outcome.
Thank you so much, Dr. Cannell, for that valuable information. Now we're going to transition to a part of the episode today where Dr. Cornell and Dr. Elena Zhang have a conversation about some of the pressing questions about implementing this within the MTSS system. And so I'm going to have you guys go ahead and take it away.
So one of the questions I have, and I think others may also be pondering some of this, is that as a school psych, when I was a part of threat assessment teams, sometimes a case can be pretty intense. And that makes it really challenging to manage all of the different moving parts. And in your experience, what's the greatest challenges that schools face when they are implementing a threat assessment model? And what are some best practices to promote their success?
Well, first of all, schools are all stretched for resources. They're understaffed, particularly with our support staff, our mental health staff. And so this can seem like it's going to be too much, another thing to do. But what folks using threat assessment tell me is it actually saves them time. If you have a student making a threat, that's very concerning to the school population, and they're going to want you to do something. And rather than reinvent the wheel or do a lot of things that maybe are not so efficient, you need a coordinated effort. And so threat assessment can actually expedite that process. We'd rather have prevention than cure. And so we have this staffing concern. We also have another barrier, which is fear. Staff get frightened, students get frightened, parents get frightened, and then they call the office and put pressure on the school administration to remove the student from school. So one of the most important things that we can do is educate our community about the threat assessment model, the threat assessment approach. That is a problem-solving, supportive, preventive approach. So that when we have such cases, they've already been advised that we have a threat assessment team. And it's good if that team is multidisciplinary, if it involves law enforcement, because those things are more reassuring to the school that we're taking the threat seriously and we're going to take appropriate action. And our own fear, finally, is the last thing, because we're all worried about making a mistake. We all have been, we've seen those terrible scenes of school shootings, and that's the last thing we ever want to have happen. So it's very important that we get to know the student, learn about them, understand what the issues and concerns are, build a relationship with that student. That's the number one way in which we're actually going to prevent a terrible act from happening.
So you've touched on multidisciplinary teams a few times now, and I think this also relates to a question. Why is it important to have a multidisciplinary team, and does this team need to be trained specifically for threat assessment, or can it just be a team that is already, supporting students who are receiving tier 3 supports?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think you need a threat assessment team, because threat assessment brings some things that folks didn't learn in graduate school, might be not otherwise be doing. So you want a team so that they're on the same page, following the same process. And we want an evidence-based approach. And typically, a school-based team can handle most cases. There are some models that say, oh, if it's a serious case, we'll bump it up to a district level or community level team. In my experience, we only need to do that with a fairly small percentage of our cases. The vast majority of cases can be handled by the school team. And I want that school team engaged, because they're actually seeing the student on a regular basis and working with them. So important to have that. Now, we want to have a team because, number one, I don't want to make that decision by myself. You probably don't want to make it by yourself, and you probably don't have the clout to arrange services and get everybody on board. So if we can cover all the disciplines in the school, that is a way for us to have a more coordinated and collaborative approach. That's why I want law enforcement on the team. I don't want them, you know, off by themselves independently deciding, oh, I've got to arrest this student or something like that. We find that when threat assessment teams have law enforcement on the team, the arrest rate is less than 1%. And there was no racial disparities in law enforcement actions. And this is in a very large sample of schools and in multiple states. So I hope that answers your question. Go ahead.
It does. I really appreciate that. And I also want to just tap a little bit more into your insights on this team, right? So when I coach district teams and school teams on implementing MTSS, I often emphasize the critical need for principals to be part of the core team, right? Because principals, they frequently have access to information and to resources that other staff typically don't have access to. So again, from your experience, why should principals be part of this team? And like, again, how do you make that space for them to be part of these teams?
Yeah, well, principals are busy. They are overburdened, and they often need to delegate in order to function and operate the school. But threats are a very important concern that requires coordinated effort. It might be the assistant principal or maybe some other principal who is delegated with school discipline matters, because we want to coordinate school discipline with threat assessment. Discipline is part of the process, but school exclusion is not the first avenue or the first option in these cases, unless it's quite serious and we need to maybe move the student temporarily for an evaluation purposes. But threat assessment teams that don't have an administrator on the team often are frustrated, because they will gather information, they will understand what is going on, they will have a plan, and the school administrator will go in a different direction. And that's really a problem. So this is why we need a team in general, to have coordinated actions.
Yeah, I think that's a really critical thing that you said there, to just make sure that everyone's on the same page, they're moving in the same direction, right? So I think this other question would actually capture something that we were just talking about the principal, and you also mentioned, you know, an AP can be part of that. So how can school leaders ensure collaboration between educators, mental health professionals and providers, and even law enforcement, right? Like your SROs, during and following a threat assessment?
Well, you need good leadership. Leadership can facilitate and resolve differences. And you want joint training. We want our teams to train together. I worked on a school threat assessment toolkit for the National Center for School Safety, which is funded by the U.S. Department of Justice. And the school safety toolkit brought together experts from across the country on best practices. They recommend training. They have identified important topics that should be covered in training. And training really should be team training, so that folks can practice the process, run through some sample cases. And that's the way really to build the cooperation that I'm talking about.
So would you also recommend that as teams go through these trainings, that it's not a one-time thing, that there is some planning to have it continuous where they revisit, do some role-playing? Sure. And so what I'm also hearing you say is like, maybe when threats do arise, that the team conducts these threat assessments, but when there are no threats, the teams should continue to convene and then practice how to handle.
You're taking the words right out of my mouth. I couldn't agree more. I've been on a threat assessment team for about 20 years, and we have training and practice. We go over cases. If we hear about a case somewhere else, we will talk about that case and how we might have handled it in our school. It's a continuous process of development, just like in any field. I mean, if you're a counselor or a therapist or a behavior interventionist, you know that, you know, you need to practice your skills. There's always different types of cases to work on. Threat assessment teams should meet regularly, cover cases when there are cases present, monitor cases that are ongoing. But in between that time, there's opportunities for additional training. And there's a lot of professional development available in threat assessment these days. A lot of folks are offering training and approaches. And once you have your team going, I think you'll be able to do that and find it useful.
Mm-hmm. So I live in the world of, I'm always thinking through like picking at words, right? So when you say routine, they should meet routinely. Could you give an example of how frequently, right? And I know that everything depends on context, right? Because I support MTSS implementation and MTSS is always context-based, right? Yeah. So when you say routinely, how frequently should these teams be meeting?
Well, it depends on the size of the school and how frequently threats are being reported. I think it's a good idea to set up a meeting that you might reserve a weekly or biweekly time for a meeting. And use that for cases, use it for training. But if you don't have cases or training scheduled, not have a meeting just for the sake of a meeting. But threat assessment teams usually schedule a weekly time. Again, it depends on how large the school is. I hate to offer a generalization because I know I got an email today from a school that they have just 40 students, and they were asking about how they would adapt the process for 40 students. On the other hand, there are schools with, 1,000 students, and so it's going to vary. You're going to have to see how much does your community report threats? Do they raise concerns? Do they feel comfortable doing it? And, of course, we want them to do that. But you may have a school where they're not reporting threats. And there, the threat assessment team needs to plan interventions for the school. Let's have a program to educate our parents and our staff and our students. And we have free training videos on that, how to educate students, staff, and parents about threat assessment. So that there may be some of that foundational work to do as well.
I think that, again, you mentioning community and involving community, this also ties really well with one of the questions that were posted about a school that is actually, 100% virtual. So in your experience, could you share more about what is the role of community engagement in keeping schools safe?
Well, the school community is critical. Everyone has a responsibility, an obligation to raise concerns and seek help. We need to educate our community that seeking help is not the same as snitching. Being concerned about protecting someone from committing a violent act to themselves or others is not snitching. It's not something done for personal gain or to get you out of trouble. It's really a way to keep our community safe. And so it's very important to encourage that culture in the community, and to make sure that there are multiple ways to report threats. Most schools have more than one avenue. Now, there are anonymous reporting systems, and I think that's fine. It's kind of a last resort. We would prefer somebody would report confidentially, and we'd be able to talk with them and really understand what they know. An anonymous system is a little bit more limited but certainly available to have because some folks may not feel comfortable otherwise.
That makes a lot of sense. How else would you support a school that is 100% virtual and you know, conducting threat assessments or also making sure that they're in a safe environment?
Yeah, that is tougher. And let me just say, social media, whether the school is virtual or not, is important. A lot of communication takes place through the internet, and school teams need to be somewhat savvy about that and to monitor that when a concern arises. But, you know, threat assessment teams can meet online. My team met online throughout COVID and still does some partial meetings online. So I think that's really important. But reaching out to students, talking with students about their concern, building relationships with students, that's really critically important. You're less concerned, of course, about building security, metal detectors, and so forth in a virtual school. But you are concerned about people's psychological safety and their sense of well-being. And that really comes from the relationship that can be built between a teacher or counselor and the students that they work with.
I don't think a lot of people are familiar with the concept of psychological safety. Could you share a little bit more about what that means?
Yeah. So I don't want to just be physically safe. I want to feel safe. And I want to feel like no one is going to injure me through harassment or bullying or antagonism or threatening behavior. I want to feel like I am respected and have no reason to feel ashamed, embarrassed, or frightened. So that's psychological safety. And psychological safety is critical to having a community where learning can take place. And it's foundational to physical safety as well.
I think that's really critical. I think that when I consider the concept of psychological safety, it's not only just for students, it's also for staff, and that it needs to be present all the time, right? And that's how we are most effective and productive, as you mentioned, when you are safe. It goes back to Maslow's hierarchy, basic psych 101.
It's hard to concentrate and learn if you're worried about what people are saying or doing or might do. Let me just say, schools often focus on physical security. School boards often are, you know, deluged with marketing campaigns to put in physical security measures, high-tech measures that sound pretty fancy, but the evidence shows don't actually improve safety that much and don't increase psychological safety. And that can be a problem because when students see a lot of metal detectors and video cameras and other devices that are basically communicating, we don't think you're safe, we don't trust you, we're worried about you, that actually diminishes psychological safety. So we want students to feel safe and secure, trusted, and that they can trust the adults in the school to go to them. So I'm always concerned when schools take a balanced approach. Some degree of physical security is appropriate for school buildings. That requires an individualized assessment of the school and the community crime rate and the resources in the school. But all too often, there's an imbalance. There's far too much emphasis on the physical security of the building and not enough emphasis on prevention and psychological safety.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's like the key piece of it being part of a comprehensive NTSS framework, right? That we are considering all those pieces and how they work together, that there are ways where we are establishing practices to create that safe and welcoming environment, but that our responses have, they match what's happening in the context, right? Which is what you were noting earlier about not overreacting and not underreacting, that you take the context and you take the data you have and make sure that you're responding in a way that matches the situation at hand. I think that's where it's so critical when we think about the fact that threat assessments help us to triage what is the most appropriate response. So it doesn't always end up as a disciplinary action. And in that, right, we have to make sure that we have fair discipline policies too. And I think that's where we know that that's how we set up that safe environment where teachers feel safer and students feel safer. Because again, from a lot of this research, it's noted that when you are implementing an effective MTSS framework plus a threat assessment model, that teachers feel like things are more fair, and so do students, right? And when they feel that confidence that things are more fair, they know that they are safe and that you will respond accordingly.
Wow, this was such a great conversation, and I hope that our listeners got something really valuable out of this. Thank you so much to Dr. Cornell and Elena for being here to kind of dive into these questions. And I know that this is such a critical piece of what schools can do to help prevent violence and keep kids safe. Thanks for listening to School and Around, a podcast hosted by Branching Minds. Go ahead and subscribe to our feed wherever you listen to podcasts. And don't forget, if you are enjoying our content, would you do us a favor and rate and review our podcast on iTunes? This helps others find our podcast and lets us know how much you love what we're creating. Branching Minds is an educational technology company using learning sciences and technology to help districts effectively personalize learning through MTSS. To learn more about us, check out our website, branchingminds.com, or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn at Branching Minds.